Good morning, and welcome to the BioWolf Symposium. I hope you all got lots of coffee because we have a tight schedule today, so we're going to plunge right into it. The symposium will officially be opened by Dr. Jack Jones, who is the Chief Information Officer of NIH.
I'd like to welcome you all to this. I'm a big fan of scientific computing. I think it's one of the most important things that CIT does. The other important thing we do is connect you to the rest of the world, so after you do something, you can tell other people about it and learn what other people have done. But this is probably our biggest end-user support activity. It's a central resource managed by CIT so that it can be available to everybody. This is a relatively large system. You probably all are aware of 6,000 processors that sit here. I came here via DOE's Advanced Strategic Computing Initiative, and so I'm fully aware that processors isn't actually the most important thing. It's the interconnection between processors and how do we do that. So we work on that a lot, and if you have ideas for that, don't hesitate to see the BioWolf staff. And last thing I'd sort of say about this is we're actually interested in biomedical applications. I've looked through the program and see a number of things that are interests. As I sit and think about the goals for NIH, I'd put at least one more thing in front of you, and that's as you sit and do your work, think about whether there might be a symbolic notation for what you do. I've told this story a number of times now. 300 years or so ago, algebraic notation became popular. Before that time, equations like A plus B equals C were written out in sentences in varying forms. And as I look at the state of biology today, I see that we're largely still describing things biological in terms of text that we write. And you can imagine the number of ways that you can write A plus B equals C. I mean, even in equations, you can write it B plus A equals C, C equals A plus B. And all of those you recognize as being logically equivalent. When they're sentences, it turned out to be much harder. And after the invention of algebraic notation, there was a huge explosion of mathematics in terms of what was possible to be proved and agreed upon by as sound proofs. And so as you work and you do complicated things, I've seen the results of some of them, can you think of ways to express them as compressed notation? I mean, I look at the molecular dynamics simulations, and they're the benefit of this largely out of physics and chemistry having compressed notation. What are those notations that might be available in the biological world? And even early suggestions of them would be, I think, very important to us. So I reiterate my welcome. I'm glad to see all of you here. I hope this is a useful day for you. And I think without further ado, we'll get started with the program.
Our first speaker is Stephen Fellini of the Helix Systems staff. Steve has been the architect of the BioWolf cluster since its origin in 1999.
Steve. Thank you. Good morning. So I'll be giving the first of three very brief technical sessions that we'll have during the course of today's symposium. The sessions will focus on various aspects of the BioWolf cluster. So we'll start with an overview of what the cluster is, how it's grown over the last 10 years, and also some accomplishments. So I thought we'd start with some factoids, some of which you've already heard. It's a central resource that's managed by CIT. It's been operational since 1999. It's one of the reasons for us being here today. It's 10 years. It's funded through the NIH Management Fund, and as a consequence, it's available to all NIH intramural scientists. In fact, it's been used by 19 of the ICs in the past year. It's grown to be one of the largest biomedical clusters in the world. So I thought I'd put this diagram up just to give you an idea of the way clusters are built. And so this is the architecture of the BioWolf cluster, and it's typical of most clusters. Start with your basic building block, which is a compute node. And that's basically a computer. It has memory, a CPU, and a disk drive. But we have 2,000 of these, and each of them has between 2 and 8 processors. Each of those is connected to a network switch via 1 gigabit per second Ethernet. And in the case of BioWolf, we have on the order of 40 of these edge switches. Each of those is connected to a core network switch. And that those connections are 10 gigabit per second Ethernet. Also connected to the core switch are a file storage and a number of special purpose nodes. One example of a special purpose node is the login node, and that's the system to which users log in to submit batch jobs, compile code, etc. Laying on top of all of this are a couple of layers of software which attempt to turn something that really consists of many computers into one. So that's an attempt, anyway. So this slide was taken from the top500.org site. And the top 500 organization tracks the most powerful 500 supercomputers in the world. And they've been doing that for a good number of years, since 93. And they publish that list of the top 500 twice a year. And this chart shows the varying architectures that have been used over time to build supercomputers. And the cluster architecture, which we just saw, is in yellow. So you can see that in 1999, when the BioWolf cluster first came into being, there were very few clusters in the top 500, only a few. But over time, it has become the absolute predominant architecture for doing supercomputing. Now, what's the reason for that? Part of the reason for the great success of clusters is their price performance. This is part of the first BioWolf cluster 10 years ago. And you can tell it's a long time ago by the color of the picture. Getting back to price performance, that comes about by the use of commodity parts. So these are essentially Pentium-based desk-side systems that have been arranged on a shelf and connected together with 100 megabit per second Ethernet, also known as fast Ethernet. So in 1999, we started with 90 of these, 90 boxes on shelves, and they were dual processors. We continued with boxes on shelves, the model of boxes on shelves, for the next few years, until we eventually reached over 600 of them in early 2003. In 2000, we continued with the Pentium processor, Intel Pentium processor, as the primary CPU. But by the end of this period of time, we went to AMD Athlons. And at this point, we're still using fast Ethernet. In 2003, we started adding blade systems. So instead of boxes on shelves, each computer is basically built on a piece of sheet metal, essentially, and you slot those pieces of sheet metal into an enclosure. And we went back to Intel Xeons, although by the end of this period, we switched back again to AMD Opterons. We have no religion about chips or anything like that. So during this period of time, we also moved to gigabit per second Ethernet, and also did some significant upgrades to the ClusterNet infrastructure. We ended 2005 with over 1,000 dual processor nodes. We retired the last of our box systems in 2006, and we continued with Opterons, Gigabit Ethernet. 2007 and 8 saw the advent of dual core systems, so that by the end of 2008, we had on the order of 4,500 processors. And so just last month, we added 224 quad core systems back to Intel again, this time the EMT64. So such that we now have over 2,000 nodes and on the order of 6,300 processors. This chart charts the growth of the cluster in three ways. The pinkish line shows the CPU hours consumed by jobs on a monthly basis. And as you can see, there's been really, truly dramatic growth over the past few years in the number of CPU hours consumed. And in fact, the last 3 months have been some of the busiest yet. The blue line shows the growth in our population of active users. We define active users as someone who actually logs into the cluster in a given month and actually does work. It's not simply the number of accounts on the system. And so if you look at this number, we actually set yet another record at the end of 08, 150 active users in December. And if you look at this over a period of 6 months, the number of active users actually is on the order of 300. So the overall population of BioWolf users is actually on the order of 300, 350, something like that. Finally, the red line shows the growth in the number of processors, and that has also steadily increased. You can see the effect of adding quad-core processors here. There were only 224 nodes, but that with quad-core processors, that comes out to over 1,700 processors. So I've been talking mainly about hardware up to this point. And, of course, while hardware is important, it's the software that allows you to do the work you need to do. And I'll just point out that the BioWolf staff supports over 200 applications in practically all domains of computational biology. So we've seen that hardware is important to sustain growth. The software is very important. But what's really most important is whether scientists using the system can translate the computer cycles they use into publishable results. And from the very start, we got our first report of publications citing the BioWolf cluster as the primary computational tool as early as the year 2000. So that was less than a year since we went into production. And that number has increased steadily ever since, to the point where this past year, in 2008, we had over 70 publications which cited the BioWolf cluster as their computational resource. We're very proud of that. So looking to the future, last year we focused on enhancing our ability to run parallel jobs. You'll hear more about that later. This year, we're going to focus on storage. This graph shows the increase in user storage over the last few years. In 2003, we had under 5 terabytes. We're now up to over 20 terabytes. And I know that that number will grow very rapidly as we add storage. We're hoping to add on the order of 200 or more terabytes this year. And if we're able to, we'd also like to increase the performance of the storage system as a whole. And I'll conclude just with a picture of the BioWolf staff, those who aren't camera shy anyway. So that's about it. Thank you.
Any questions? Any questions?
If there are any speakers in the audience who haven't spoken to us, could you come and talk to me so I can identify you? We've communicated by email, but not always face-to-face. Okay, we'll get started again. Our next speaker is Ad Bax from the Lab of Chemical Physics at NIDDK. And the title of his talk is De Novo Protein Structure Generation from Incomplete Chemical Shift Assignments.
Thanks, Susan. I'd like to start out by thanking you and the other organizers of this symposium for A, for putting it together, and B, for giving me the opportunity to present some of our work. We've been grateful users of the BioWolf system over the past quite a few years, actually. And I'll be talking about an application of the work that there's a lot of excitement about in the structural biology community over the last year or so. A relatively recent effort to try to determine NMR protein structures from just chemical shifts rather than the classical approach. What I'll try to do is give you a little bit of the basics, what this is all about, and then show you how we can exploit the existing protein structural database, the PDB, for determining new structures in a simpler, faster way than was possible before. A little introduction what NMR is. We're looking at the nuclei of atoms. They're surrounded by electrons, and if we put them in a magnetic field, the electron cloud will shield the magnetic field. So the magnetic field experienced by the magnetic nucleus is shielded by this factor sigma from the external magnetic field. That is called the chemical shift. So if you look at a small molecule like ethanol, this is actually one of the very first NMR spectra recorded in the 50s, you see that the hydroxyl proton has an electron withdrawing oxygen next to it. It therefore has feels the strongest field, and it shows up to the left. The methyl group has the least electron withdrawing power for the carbon, and the magnetic field is the weakest. It shows up on the right. So we have three different chemical groups here, three different resonances. You go to a small protein here, 150 residues, staphylococcal nuclease, we end up with about 1,000 chemically distinct hydrogens in the protein. That means we end up with 1,000 different resonance lines. And as you can see, this gets pretty crowded here. Each of them has a different chemical shielding, chemical shift, and therefore a slightly different resonance frequency. There's also a very intense water signal that goes way through the roof of Building 10 if it weren't truncated here. Because, of course, the concentration of water being about 50 molar, that means 100 molar in terms of protons, whereas the protein concentration is only about 1 millimolar, so those are five orders of magnitude weaker, those signals, than the water signal itself. Before one can say anything about the structure of a protein, we first have to identify which of those resonance lines corresponds to which hydrogen in the protein. That's called the resonance assignment process. And the procedure used for that these days was originally also developed here at NIH in the late 80s, early 90s. It involves isotopic incorporation of carbon-13 and nitrogen-15 nuclei, typically by expressing the protein in E. coli that are fed with N15 ammonium chloride, carbon-13 glucose, and the poor buggers don't have any choice. They have to incorporate those isotopes in the protein they're making. It's the only source of food they've got. So the only reason I mention this is we're going to not just use hydrogen chemical shifts, we're also going to use carbon-13 and nitrogen-15 chemical shifts. These also have a magnetic moment and therefore have a resonance frequency that can be measured. And those chemical shifts, particularly carbon-13, turn out to be very informative from a structural perspective. Now, classically, the way protein structures get determined, work for which Gut-Wuthrich received the Nobel Prize a few years ago, relies on the measurement of distances between pairs of protons. So if protons, hydrogen nuclei in a protein are less than about 5 angstroms apart, there is an appreciable rate at which they can exchange their spin magnetization through a mechanism that I won't go into. And the closer they are together, the faster they'll exchange their nuclear spin magnetization. Those rates can be measured. And by measuring those rates, we get measures for distances between pairs of protons. And from that, we can put together the fold, the structure of the protein backbone, and the side chains in a now very well-established method. More than half the protein structures determined around the world by NMR use the program Explore NIH, developed by Charles Swedes, Marius Klor, adapted from the original Explore work, and it's the standard approach being used. Now, the time-consuming part in this procedure turns out to be the analysis of those distances, identification from the NMR spectrum. One has to measure thousands of those distances, and identifying which pair you're looking at is not necessarily trivial. And that's why about 8 or 9 years ago, we tried a different approach, where instead of measuring those distances, you would try to measure the orientation of bond vectors relative to the magnetic field. And what we use for that is a technology known as dipolar coupling measurement. And what we could do is measure orientation of bonds relative to the magnetic field. And we said, rather than trying to determine directly what the structure is from those bond orientations, because there's degeneracy, we relied on the protein database, the crystallographic database, and asked, is there any fragment of a protein in the database that I could orient in such a way that it agrees with the orientations that I've measured? And as you can see, if we have enough of those dipolar couplings, enough of those orientations, the best fitting fragments that I pull out of the PDB would overlap nicely with the yellow one here. That's the reference for which I measured the dipolar couplings. So I can measure, get those kind of fragments. And if I get enough of those fragments, and I choose them for overlapping segments, I can basically segmentally build up. I get the orientation and the structure of each of those fragments. I can just translate and best fit them and build the protein structure this way. Now, that of course, that requires that, A, that I don't make any mistakes, because for example, if this one were wrong, this protein would sort of go out into outer space. It would show poor packing, and it would basically be a very, very wrong structure. So it relies on every step being complete. That's why we make those fragments overlapping, so there's more redundancy in making it more robust. Nevertheless, even though this works with ideal data, it's still a lot of work, because now we have to measure the orientation of each of those bond factors, and that sort of is almost as much work as measuring those NOEs to begin with. And the procedure itself isn't that robust. Like I said, if you make a mistake here somewhere, we'd have a problem. It was more of a proof of principle demonstration that we can actually determine structures without any NOEs, which had long been posed as being impossible to do. So it is possible, but it's still pretty difficult to do. Now, when I got a new postdoc about 3 years ago, Yang Xian in the group, he said, well, could we determine those fragments just based on chemical shift information? Because those chemical shifts is what we get at the very early stage of the NMR analysis. And can we use those chemical shifts to fetch fragments out of the database and then put them together, the same kind of procedure? And I suggested to him, well, that's going to be a tough job, because those chemical shifts are not so uniquely related to structure. That relation is somewhat nebulous. So if you want to go that route, the first thing you'll have to do is come up with a better way of correlating chemical shift with structure of the fragments. So realizing that, he went to work and he said, well, you know what I can do is I can use a procedure. He developed a program known as Sparta. This is Yang here. Where he's actually bootstrapping from the NMR structural database to use the much larger crystallographic structural database. And what he does is he tries to come up with a procedure that he can predict chemical shifts for crystal structures. So once he has predicted chemical shifts for the crystallographic database, he can then use the crystallographic database to compare it with a new protein for which he just has chemical shifts. And at the same time, exploiting the wide structural diversity that is present in the crystallographic, the very large crystallographic database. So to do this, he bootstraps from a much smaller database of about 200 proteins for which we know chemical shifts and we know the structure, either from NMR or crystallography. And what he does, he breaks this protein up into fragments of three adjacent residues, and then he asks for any fragment of three residues, can I look in my 200 protein database to find other three residue fragments that are structurally similar? So he realized that the phi and the psi angles are very close. He comes up with a scoring function. The chi 1 angles similar. The residue types go in there, having similar residue types. You like to have a valine or a hydrophobic or an isoleucine where you have a valine, or an aromatic residue where you have an aromatic residue. So based on the similarity score function, he picks the 20 best matching fragments out of the NMR database, looks at what the chemical shift is for this fragment, and he gets the average chemical shifts, and he gets the predicted the scatter in the chemical sieves that he pulls out. So he's able to use, just based on structure, this 200 database, NMR database, to predict for a fragment of a crystal structure what the chemical sieves of those nuclei are going to be. All right? Now, doing that, you can see how well or how poorly he can predict chemical sieve, compare it with this experiment here. And as you can see, there are good correlations, but they're certainly not very precise. Right? So there's still a fair bit of scatter left. Those would be for the N15 backbone nitrogens. This is for the amide hydrogens, the alpha protons, the C-alpha carbons. It has the strongest correlation coefficient. But nevertheless, we have a fair bit of scatter. And as a little aside, we're trying to identify more quantitatively what this residual scatter is due to. That comes from factors other than the backbone angles phi and psi. And we're using the BioWolf cluster to do Gaussian calculations to try to define what kind of bond distortions, angular distortions, give rise to this additional scatter. Electric fields are the primary dominating effect, turns out to be. In any case, having those correlations, which turn out to be better than any preceding program, he can make those predictions, what the chemical shifts are, and he's not the first one to do this. We actually had an in-house program, this orange one, and what you can see is that his RMS in the prediction is only about 10 to 20% lower than what it was. That turns out to be a ShiftX program developed in Canada by David Wishart, and as you can see, well, he comes out somewhat lower, but only about 10, 15%. Wishart's program comes out a little bit better than our own original effort for most of them, not for all nuclei. In any case, for all nuclei, his new SPARTA program comes out about, on average, 10 to 20% better. That turns out to have actually some significant impact, as I'll show you in a few slides. The other important advance of his program is that he knows the uncertainty of the predicted chemical shifts, because he had this 20 best hits, and he looked at the scatter, what the 20 best hit was, and that correlates closely with the error. So if he looks at the scatter of the 20 and how good or how bad his prediction is, turns out there's an almost linear correlation for each of those six types of nuclei. And he can use that later on in trying to use this as a weighting factor when pulling fragments out of the crystallographic database. Now, this is the quality of the fragments that you get as a function of how big a fragment you take. And what I'm comparing this to is the vertical ordinate is relative to picking a random fragment. So this is the relative RMSD, and the RMSD for those backbone fragments at 0.2 would be 5 times better than picking a random fragment. Using the old chemical shift structure correlation, the in-house one that I showed, it was orange on the preceding bar graph, it would be about 3 times better instead of 5 times better. If we use sequence only, that is what David Baker uses for chemical shift, for a structure prediction de novo without any NMR input, he's about twice as good as picking a fragment at random, okay? Which is actually pretty impressive to pick it just based on sequence with this kind of, with twice as good as picking at random, is turns out to be a remarkable feat. I didn't realize how good this was until we tried to improve this, and we never were able to get below about 0.85 with our own more primitive efforts at doing this. So this is a rather sophisticated approach that Baker is using. In any case, you can see that adding chemical shifts improves this by about a factor of 2.5, which is a rather dramatic improvement. In doing this, then, we can pull fragments, but they're not of super high quality. They're actually pretty marginal quality fragments still out of the database. And this is sort of like cartoon-like shown here again. I've got now fragments for different segments of the protein, and then the hard part is going to be to put those fragments together and make a globular structure out of it. I don't even know how those fragments are oriented relative to the magnetic field or relative to one another, so the assembly process, I certainly can't use this very primitive, simple-minded translate and best fit approach that I used previously for those much higher quality fragments that I got from dipolar couplings. In any case, the original approach that we took was working with George Rose and his Linus program at Hopkins. And that program is primarily geared at making as well hydrogen-bonded structures as possible. And it's really only geared towards the backbone and making proper hydrogen bonds. When in the publishing process with George and his group, a paper appeared in PNAS, and we were clearly scooped by Michele Vrendruscolo at Cambridge University, and he developed a program called Cheshire, which is based on basically a massive assembly computational procedure, a Monte Carlo procedure, to put fragments similarly selected together. He was using our old chemical shift scoring program to select fragments that, like I showed you before, was about 1.5 times worse than the Sparta program. So when we saw this, well, A, we were a little bit disappointed, but B, it was remarkable how well that Vrendruscolo's program already worked, despite the fragments being rather poor. So we were quite keen on taking the same approach and at least seeing how much help we got by using the better fragments from Yang's Sparta program. And we tried to get the program from Michele, who suggested it would be available soon, but after waiting for 3 or more months and it's still not being quite ready for the outside world, because obviously it was a homegrown kind of program, we realized that this program really is very similar to David Baker's Rosetta program. David is at the University of Washington, and he's been a key player in this CASP structure prediction process. And all we needed to do was substitute the fragments that David uses for our chemical shift selected fragments and do those assemblies. Now, these are very time-consuming Monte Carlo calculations. We take typically 200 fragments for each of those instead of 10 or 20 that we used before. And he's got a two-stage procedure for assembling those fragments into a compact protein fold. Now, that turns out to be incredibly robust and working remarkably well, despite being computationally quite intensive. An example here, the first two examples that Yang tried out on are two PET proteins. One is GB3, a small 56 residue alpha-beta domain of a protein. The other one is ubiquitin, another one that we've used for method development in the lab for a long time. And as you can see, the backbone determined with this chemical shift Rosetta approach fits perfectly with the experimentally determined crystal structure or experimentally determined NMR structure to within better than an angstrom on the backbone. Actually, the more important stuff is shown up here. What you see here is the energy of the 10,000 structures that he's calculated as a function of how far away the backbone coordinates are from the reference structure. And what you can see is that the closer the structure falls to the experimental structure, like I said, he calculates 10,000 structures, the closer, the lower the energy is. And for reference, if he doesn't use the chemical shift to select the fragments, he never gets down to the same kind of very low energies. If he takes the crystal structure, it actually goes even a little bit lower. All right, so those structures are not perfect, but they're much better than doing it without chemical shifts. And they get to within, like I said, better than an angstrom on the backbone, at least for those two very nice model systems. So after having done this, he got very excited and quickly did some more. So those were the next 6 structures that he did. Then he took 10 more, and again, they worked very well. And at this point, since all of them worked, we were getting a little bit suspicious. I talked to David Baker, and he says, well, David says, we can predict the structure for any protein where we know the answer. And I sort of heard him, and I realized a little that I mistrusted Yang, but at the same time, it's sort of hard to know what kind of prior information you're putting into your program. So I said, well, David said, we really need to do a blind prediction just like we do with the CASP structure prediction program. And fortunately, we have those structural genomics programs going on, and it's almost like a factory there. You've got one group of guys that determine the chemical shifts, and then the next set of guys measures NOEs, and then another group of guys takes those NOEs and tries to calculate structures. So we talked to Thomas Sapersky, Cheryl Arrowsmith, Guy Monteleone, and asked, can we get some of the chemical shifts as soon as you've got them? And then we'll try to do this with our method, and at the same time, your guys independently use the conventional procedure. And doing that, we got 9 of them, and as you can see, all 9 of them come out very well, except for some loop regions that are dynamically disordered, where we have a real tough time. And again, the structure is ill-determined for those loop regions. But as you can see here, this seems to be remarkably robust, at least for small proteins. I'll come back in a few minutes on what the limits of this approach really are. Now, what we're doing here still is we're comparing, or we're using a very extensive, complete set of chemical shifts. We're requiring N15, amide proton, alpha proton, alpha carbon, C-beta carbon, carbonyl chemical shifts. That means six chemical shifts per residue. And sometimes we may not have six, depending on how the protein behaves or how the protein was labeled. So one question you can ask is, can we get away with leaving out the carbonyl chemical shifts? And if we look at the energies, they're almost as low as what they are for the reference structure here. We can leave out the alpha proton shifts, and we do basically equally well. Or we can leave out two sets of chemical shifts. We don't do quite as well, but still pretty good. We get some low energy structures, not quite as low, but they're still very close to the reference. We can leave out the carbonyl shifts and the alpha proton shifts, or we can leave out three sets of chemical shifts at the same time. Now, the results get pretty thin here in terms of low energy structures, but nevertheless, we can use just three sets of chemical shifts instead of six. So we're pretty happy here. In practice, however, what frequently happens with the protein is that a small part of it may be completely invisible. There may be a turn region that goes through conformational exchange on a microsecond time scale. The NMR signals just disappear in nirvana because of the time scale that those processes are taking place. That's well understood. So no chemical shift, you'd say, you get no structure. And that's true, particularly by conventional methods, that can be a real problem. And here we would end up with rather poor fragments. Now, to solve that conundrum, we take recourse to the original Rosetta approach, David Baker's Rosetta approach. If we only have like 5 or 10 residues for which we're missing chemical shifts, instead of using Sparta, which would make very poor predictions because there's no input, we're resorting back to Rosetta to predict what the backbone angles and the conformation of those peptide fragments are. So what we're trying to do is make a hybrid approach that defaults to the original Rosetta in case there are missing chemical shifts. So instead of the standard approach where we take our fragments just from the crystallographic database, what he's doing first is he's pre-sorting them, Yang selection, pre-sorts them based on David Baker's Rosetta, taking the best 2,000 candidates from Rosetta, and selects from those best 2,000 out of a total of about 2 million present in our crystallographic database. He selects then the top 10% based on chemical shift. And if there is no chemical shift, well, the top 2,000 is still a 0.1% selection already made based on David Baker's program. This hybrid approach turns out to be quite robust and working very nicely. You can see that here for the shaded regions, they're very thinly shaded. There were no chemical shifts. The backbone RMSD for the NMR selected, the conventionally selected one, shoots way up. So those are bad fragments up here. But using David Baker's approach, the RMSD drops way down, not as good as for regions where we have chemical shifts, but nevertheless acceptable, and we're allowed to come up, or we can manage to get converged structures for those proteins, okay, low energy, whereas the regular approach, those bad fragments, would not give us any convergence. Another case is for a paramagnetic protein. If we have a paramagnetic metal in the protein, we can basically obliterate, we lose all our signal, but using this hybrid approach allows us to calculate structures even for paramagnetic proteins. Now, last slide is, when does it fail? Does this always work? And can we tell when it works and when it doesn't work? Well, the criteria that we use for it to work is that the lowest energy structure, in this case that would be this one here, has to cluster with the next 9 selected ones. So if you take the 10 lowest energy ones, they all have to cluster within about 2 angstroms of the backbone. If they don't, like for these proteins here, the next lowest energy one is like 5 angstroms away from the backbone, or more than 5 angstroms. So I do everything relative to the conformer that has the lowest energy. If they don't cluster, there's no convergence. That's happened for quite a few proteins. As soon as we're larger than about 130, 140 amino acids, typically we don't get convergence anymore. There's 3 examples. One actually where we get a wrong answer. It converged, but it turns out to be the wrong structure. That is for a domain-swapped dimer, because the chemical shifts for the domain-swapped dimer are the same as for the monomer. So if we don't know that we've got a dimer, it will just calculate the monomeric structure. All right? So one has to know what the dimerization or trimerization state of the protein is, which you get from light scattering or some other kind of trivial technique. This was a protein that gave poor convergence initially because the wrong set of chemical shifts were used for it, but even after using the correct chemical shifts, convergence was borderline marginal, and it stayed 3 angstroms away from the correct structure. This one here is an interesting one. It turns out to be a very complicated fold. It's a protein determined by Kurt Wüthrich, published about a year ago, and he publishes, you can see the fold here, this thing has to actually start folding from the middle. And apparently Rosetta is poorly set up to simulate this in a Monte Carlo procedure. Now, you might say, is this the correct folder? Is the correct structure? We think so, because Kurt Wüthrich did it. He's one of the most careful workers in the field. But B, there's one structure that we get out of this 10,000, the lowest energy one, that's actually the only one that has this fold. Now, if we had been able to calculate a million of them, we probably would have had convergence and been able to prove that this is indeed the correct fold. But computationally, this was done on the Boeing server, that using those screensaver programs, using 10,000 nodes and running for quite some time. So it is computationally extremely demanding. Sometimes we run one of those, or frequently we run one of those structures over a weekend on the BioWolf, and that's typically what it takes. Those nodes that we get, of course, are faster than the screensaver nodes that we get out of the Boeing server. So with this, I hope I've shown you that actually there is some serious need for computing, in this case massively parallel computing. Other cases, of course, require just raw speed for single processors. So at this point, I hope I've shown you indeed that there is some serious use for computing in our work. And I'm very grateful to the BioWolf and the people supporting it for allowing us to use it. These are the people involved in the work. You've seen Yang's face over here and various other guys in the group and one graduate student working on various projects. Thank you very much.
For the residues which are scattered through the protein, and whenever they're contiguous, how long these contiguous gap?
Let me repeat the question. So for the missing chemical shifts, if chemical shifts are scattered, missing throughout the protein, is that a problem? And how big a gap of consecutive residues can we miss chemical shifts for? If they're scattered, the missing chemical shifts, it's basically no problem whatsoever. Here or there. When they're consecutive, indeed, that's the more serious problem, and like is the case for the calbinin protein that I showed, where we're missing the entire metal binding site, that's about 15 residues. We can typically work with 15 residues without too much of a problem, but we'd like to have at least 80% of the total protein assigned. Because like I said, it defaults to Rosetta, the structure becomes poorer, we have to predict this region now based on Rosetta. Now, Rosetta is good for 50 to 100 residue proteins. So in principle, we could miss up to 50 or 100 residues. We haven't gotten a case where we've been able to test that.
And the size and the length of the typical fragment you use to build the protein from is about 10 residue or 15?
We actually use, most of the time we use the default Rosetta thing, that it picks 3 residue fragments and 9 residue fragments. The newer version allows you to pick any set of residue fragment length. 3 or 9 residues still seems to be about as robust and functional as any of the other ones.
And the last question, probably you never tried that, but how the approach relies on the database of the structure. If you just for the sake of the argument, for the sake of the trials, reduce the size of the database, how robust the approach is?
We've actually tried that. So the question is, how much do we depend on the size of the database? So could we cut the crystallographic database by a factor of 5, 10, or 100? There is a significant deterioration in performance when we go down by a factor of 2 in the database size. So we're using about 6,000 proteins. Cutting it down to 3,000 proteins is roughly equivalent to leaving out the carbonyl chemical shifts. So there is a significant improvement. But At the same time, I must say that there's no advantage in cutting down the database size because the time-consuming part is this Monte Carlo assembly step. Selecting the fragments is a matter of less than an hour on a single CPU desktop. So that's not where the time goes. The time goes into the assembly and calculating, finding low-energy conformations.
I got it, but the question is not about how fast it is, but the question is about how robust it is. And you mean the bigger the better database you have. And well, okay.
Right. If we can make the database 10 times larger, it probably will get another few percent better. But we haven't really tried that. I mean, we've working with what we've got.
I think we have another question.
Hi. Excuse me. I'm Belle. I'm a staff writer for the NIH Record. Would you bear with me if I ask you a question I could translate into layman's terms?
Sure.
Bear with me, okay. I think it was Voltaire who said, if you change something enough quantitatively, you will change it qualitatively. So if do you believe that BioWolf has changed your research qualitatively, or has it allowed you to do it well, more of it well, faster? Or is it too soon to say?
Well, I'd be overstating it if I said it's BioWolf alone. It's this massive parallel computing is what is making this new approach possible. So BioWolf is not the only cluster out there. The original one that we used was in collaboration with David Baker from the University of Washington, who was using the Berkeley Open Infrastructure Network for computing. But not having access to that, we would have been dead in the water, not being able to do anything except for wait for 6 weeks if BioWolf wouldn't have been there. So it really, I mean, it's key for us to have access to BioWolf. And, of course, now with the program set up, we completely depend on it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Ruth Nusinov from the Computational Structural Biology Group, CCR Nanobiology Program at NCI. The title of her talk is Modeling Toxic Alzheimer Amyloid Ion Channels.
So first, thank you very much for the invitation to come and speak at this BioWolf symposium. I would like to say that for us, we just heard one way in which the BioWolf has been extremely useful and indeed crucial for making the project possible. The same holds for us. In our particular case, it's modeling, and we couldn't have possibly, as I'll just describe, carry out this particular modeling. And in our case also, this modeling has brought about experimental undertaking, major experimental undertaking by two groups at the University of Chicago and at UCLA to actually test this model. So it's BioWolf initiated project, which is now being tested by experiments, and so far, it's consistent with the results. So the title of my talk is Modeling Amyloid Conformations. So the title of my talk is Modeling Amyloid Conformations and Toxic Ion Channels. Assuming that not everyone in the audience is up to date on the amyloid and Alzheimer field, what I would like to do is to take a couple of minutes off and to give a brief introduction as to the state of the field. Until a few years ago, it was generally accepted that it is those long characteristic fibrils that we so often see in textbooks and in experimental papers dealing with Alzheimer and other neurodegenerative diseases, that it is these long fibrils which are responsible for cell death. Today, we know that actually it is the other way around. The less stable and more brittle those fibrils are, the more toxic. It is not the fibrils which are cytotoxic to the cells. Rather, it is the small oligomers. The question then arises, in which way are these oligomers toxic? What is the mechanism? And here there is a big and very heated debate in the field. Everyone in the field agrees that indeed it is those small oligomers, or rather the oligomers, which are the toxic species. Everyone also agrees that the immediate cause is ion leakage, particularly calcium leading to calcium homeostasis. The question is, how do the oligomers bring about this calcium homeostasis? And here, there are two schools of thought. The first school, largely headed by Charlie Glabe and his colleagues, maintains that despite the fact that they looked and looked, they were unable to detect any amyloid channels in the membrane. On the other hand, what they did see is medium to large oligomers sitting on the membrane surface. Consequently, there is a large interaction area between the oligomers and the membrane, leading to disturbance of the membrane structure, membrane thinning, and calcium leakage. On the other hand, the other group maintains that consistently and reproducibly they see these amyloid channels. For us, as computational biologists, and with the availability of the BioWolf, the question was, what can we do to help in addressing this problem and in trying to resolve this controversy? So our goals are modeling amyloid conformations and correlating these with experimental data were available, obtaining clues to the minimal seed size, the driving force, the structural organization, and the mechanism of amyloid formation, and in particular, targeting the mechanism of amyloid toxicity. There are data suggesting that oligomers are the toxic species, that there is membrane damage, and that ion leakage is involved. We started this work just about 10 years ago, indeed, actually, when the BioWolf was just getting up. And the first work was by Bouyong Ma in the group, and he modeled, using the BioWolf, the first model of the Alzheimer A-beta, in this case for residues 16 through 35. What Bouyong suggested was that the monomer has a U-shaped with a salt bridge between this aspartic and the lysine, and that the other monomers are stacked in parallel on top of each other. Shortly thereafter, Tycho and his colleagues here at the NIH published their solid-state NMR-based model, and we were extremely happy to see that Tycho's structure, also here is a monomer, was extremely similar to the BioWolf generated model. Also a U-shape, the same salt bridge, the same turn conformation. The monomers were stacked in parallel, and the only difference between the computational model and the solid-state NMR-based model was that here Tycho has rotated the C-terminal strand on this glycine such that the side chains that pointed up in the computational model pointed down in the solid-state NMR-based model. In 2005, Lourdes and his colleagues, or Lourdes et al., have published their model, experiment-based model, using the Tycho solid-state NMR data, 2D NMR, EM, and mutational data. Again, we were very happy to see it's a U-shape. The monomers are stacked in parallel, the same salt bridge, and the side chains pointed in the same direction as in the computational model. And the only difference between the Lourdes et al. Model and the computational and Tycho's model were models were in the conformation of the turn. In 2006, Tycho has updated his model. Now the glycine here the C-terminal is rotated on the glycine here, such that now all three models agree there is a U-shape shape, there is a U-turn shape, the monomers are stacked in parallel, the same salt bridge conformation, the same salt bridge forms, except for the different conformation of the turn in the Lourdes et al. As compared to these two. Now, the computational model is for residues 16 through 35. Tycho's model is for 9 through 40, since residues 1 through 8 were disordered in experiment. De Lourdes et al. For residues 17 through 42, since residues 1 through 16 were disordered. So what we have done is to take the NMR-based coordinates of Lourdes et al. From the PDB, here a pentamer, and using the BioWolf, Ji Zheng in the group has started simulating it. And what he has observed is that the turn expanded and water and ion, a sodium ion, passed through the channel during the simulations. However, as one can see, the ends frayed, suggesting that this structure is not very stable. He then extended the pentamer to a decamer, but still, as one can see, the ends stray, and one can see it is unstable. To try and stabilize it, what G has then done, again using the BioWolf, is to take two oligomers and stack them against each other. Now, there are two ways in which this can be done. Either C-terminal to C-terminal or N-terminal to N-terminal. And these two are not symmetric, since here, as one can see from the colors, we have hydrophobic interactions. Here, the N-terminal is charged. We have two salt bridges. What the simulations have shown is that while both are stable, this one, as might be expected, is more stable. Based on this, we have suggested that the architecture of a beta are with two sheets stacked together, closely together, and there are solvated cavities within them. And this type of architecture was also suggested by Gerhard Hammer a little earlier. Now we come to toxicity. First, experimental data. Everyone in the field agrees that neurotoxicity via beta amyloid oligomers leads to cell death. Everybody also agrees that the mechanism is related to dysregulation and or destabilization of cellular ionic homeostasis, particularly calcium. However, some experiments indicated the presence of toxic beta-amyloid ion channels, whereas others, like Gleib and his colleagues, did not observe any. Yet, as I mentioned, some experiments observed consistently and reproducibly the ion channels, these amyloid ion channels. Here we have the atomic force microscopy of Ratnesh Lal and his colleagues. Here for the Alzheimer A beta, 1 through 40. Here for the alpha-synuclein, the agent in the Parkinson's disease. Here, the British BRI, the ABRI, which is the British amyloid peptide, from the cause of the familial British dementia. In all cases, the outer diameter is 8 to 10 nanometers. The pore diameter is 1 to 2 nanometers. And more. Here, again, Ratnesh Lal has taken the AFM images of Aidan, familial Danish dementia, amylin, the cause of which is the islet amyloid polypeptide, IAPP, and the serum amyloid A. Again, in all cases, the outer diameter is 8 to 10 nanometers, pore diameter is 1 to 2. So what we thought we would do is as follows. Let us start with the NMR or the experiment-based coordinates and see if at the end of the simulations we are able to obtain channels with shapes, morphologies, and dimensions consistent with those observed by AFM. So what we have then done is to take the coordinates of the two structures that we had, the Lourdes et al. And the Tycho, and create annular structures. In this case, this is the Lourdes et al. We took from the PDB the pentamer. Five monomers here are stacked. We extended it, and we bent it to create a circle, an annular structure. Of course, there are two ways in this in which this can be done. You can either bend it in this direction, or you can bend it in this direction. So we have tried both, and the situation is not symmetric. If we bend it in this direction, the hydrophobic C-terminal faces the solvated pore, and the charged N-terminal faces the bilayer. If we bend it in this direction, the charged N-terminal faces the solvated pore, and the hydrophobic C-terminal faces the bilayer. So, just to show again the two channels, here is the solvated pore. Here, facing the bilayer, is our C-terminal, hydrophobic. Facing the solvated pore is the N, the N-terminal strand, that is to say, the charged strand. Here, it's the other topology. Again, the solvated pore. Facing it is the C-terminal hydrophobic strand. Facing the bilayer is the N-terminal charged strand. Here, just to show that as far as size goes, we are okay. The length of the structure of the U-turn extends very well over the thickness of the bilayer. And we use the DOPC bilayer simply because we wanted to stay as close to experiment as possible. And Lal has taken his AFM images in the DOPC bilayer. So here are the two annular structures that we have created, here with 24 monomers. Here, the hydrophobic C-terminal on the inside, the charged N-terminal facing the bilayer. Here, the charged N-terminal facing the solvated pore, the hydrophobic C-terminal facing the bilayer. This is what happened at the end of the simulations. What we observed is that actually the channel broke into ordered subunits with disordered monomers in between. This is actually quite easy or straightforward to understand. When we look at our annular structure, naturally, the inner diameter is much smaller than the outer diameter. So here, at the inner diameter, what we have is a perfectly hydrogen-bonded beta sheet because the distances between the beta strands are right for formation of such hydrogen bonds. This is not the situation for the outer strands here. Because the diameter is larger, the strands are too far apart to form hydrogen bonds. During the simulations, what happens is that at some regions, they come together to form perfect hydrogen bonds, to form beta sheets. Of course, with the consequence that if it shrinks at some places, at other places, we have monomers forming then this disordered structure, disordered monomers explaining these. Here we can see a time series of the channel conformation in the DOPC bilayer. Time zero starts to relax at 5 nanoseconds. We see that it starts forming the subunits. And here, after 30 nanoseconds, the relaxed structure, we see the subunits formation. Here, to compare with LAL's AFM images for A-beta-140, here LAL had 5 subunits, here he had 6 subunits, here in the simulations, we obtained 3 subunits with the disordered monomers in between. And this is for A-beta-1742. This is the LURS et al. Coordinates, starting from the LURS et al. Coordinates. This is the other topology, where this charged N-terminal faces the bilayer and the hydrophobic C-terminal faces the pore. What happens is no ordered subunits. When we look at the pore-preserving channel with the charged N-terminal facing the pore and the hydrophobic C-terminal facing the bilayer, this is time zero. This is after 30 nanoseconds. The channel expands. On the other hand, for the other topology, when the hydrophobic C-terminal faces the pore and the charged N-terminal faces the bilayer, time zero, after 30 nanoseconds, we see that the channel collapses. We also tried additional sizes, 36 mer and a 12 mer, and here are the diameters. And now we're trying also 16 mer. This is what happens for the 36 mer. It also forms subunits, in this case 6 subunits, with disordered monomers in between. But one can also see that this channel is too large to be supported by the bilayer. It assumes a water droplet-like shape, and one can assume that with time, some subunits are going to drift away. Actually, this is what we are suggesting for all channels, because when you have subunits connected by disordered monomers, this is not a stable conformation. These are toxic ion channels. These are not ion channels which have been optimized by evolution. This is another run for another 24 mer of the channel of the favorable topology with the charged N-terminal facing the pore, the hydrophobic C-terminal facing the bilayer, in this case, 5 subunits. Again, to compare with LAL's images, 5 subunits, 6 subunits, and in the simulations, 6 subunits, 5 subunits, and our 3 subunits. And from additional trajectories, again, 5 subunits, 6 subunits, and another 5 subunits. As far as the dimensions go, here, outer dimension, 8 nanometers, inner, 2.7. Here, in this trajectory, inner dimension, inner pore diameter, 2.5 nanometers, outer diameter, 8 nanometers. This is the Tycho structure. The pore diameter, I should say that Tycho has very kindly provided us with his coordinates, and we are very grateful for that. The inner pore has a diameter of 2.2 nanometers, the outer diameter 7.8 nanometers. Again, here are LAL's images, 1 through 40, 5 subunits, 6 subunits, and this is 1 through 40, A beta 142, again by Ratnesh Lal, 4 subunits, 6 subunits. So when we compare AFM versus simulations, as far as shape goes, similar subunit organization. However, of course, the simulations provide atomistic detail, which the AFM cannot provide. As far as dimensions go, similar shape diameters. In the AFM 140, outer is between 8 to 12 nanometers. The inner is 2 nanometers. In the simulations, for the 1742, the outer is 8 nanometers, inner diameter 2.5. For the TICOS A beta, 9 to 42, I should say that we added two more residues. The outer is 7.8, the inner is 2.2. So the bottom line is we started from NMR-based U-shaped A-beta, and we obtained channels which are consistent with atomic force microscopy. Of course, this is not the end of the story. The question is, can the model channels conduct ions? We know that this is the heart of toxicity. Experimentally, the bilayer ion permeability is increased in the presence of amyloids. Unfortunately, as we know, the contactus phenomena are on timescales which are not affordable by simulations. So we cannot observe or measure these by simulations. However, simulations can follow amyloid interaction probability, which is what we have done. So here we have the cation ring in the pore. The calcium is in blue. This is a head-on view. And here is a projection along the z-axis of the ion distribution in the pore. Again, the calcium is in blue. So far, I tried to emphasize throughout the talk, the simulations have been for two fragments, A-beta 1742, the Lourdes et al., and A-beta 940, because these were TICOS, and for these we had coordinates. On the other hand, Lal's experiments were for fragments 140 or 142. One would assume that the behavior of 940 or 1742 would be similar to 140 or 142, but of course there is no assurance. I called Ratnesh Lal and asked him, would he be interested in looking also at our fragments, at the 940 and 1742? And I was absolutely enthusiastic when he said, of course, he'll be happy to do this. So here are the results that we have received from Ratnesh. This is the AFM. This is the low resolution, 1742. This is the higher resolution, A-beta 1742, 4 subunits, 5 subunits, and A-beta 942, TICO structure, based on TICO structure, I should say, 5 subunits, 4 subunits. Next, what Lal has done is to do experiments on the calcium uptake in APP-deficient transgenic cells. This is the control. This is for the A-beta 1742. This is for the A-beta 942. Clearly, there is calcium uptake by the cells. Here, the control. Here, we have 1742 and 942. Here, he added zinc, of course, channel blocker, indeed, no calcium uptake, and we can see this in the green here. So again, 1742, 942, this is the control, and this is with zinc. Then, Bruce Kagan from UCLA joined us and did a single channel conductance on these. This is 1742. 942, 1742 with the zinc added, blocking the channel, and TICOS, 942 with the zinc again, blocking the channel. And then we realized that actually the 1742 is formed in vivo by the enzyme alpha secretase. And the 1742 also is found in amyloid plaques in Alzheimer, along with 140 and 142, and it is found in the Down syndrome. I should also say that now we are carrying out simulations with the mutants, particularly prolines, but also some others, and in conjunction with these experiments, both calcium uptake, AFM, and the single channel conductance, and also some other mutants. And so far, so good consistency with the simulations. Of course, and this is something I should stress, this never proves a model. Consistency with experiment does not prove a model. It only says that the model so far is a viable candidate. There could be additional models which are also consistent with the data. Yeah. And with this, I shall close. And I shall, most of all, I would like to acknowledge Yun Bam Zheng, who has done all the simulations in the bilayer that I have shown you. Ji Zheng has done the simulations in water. Bu Yong has done the initial modeling of the A-beta, and he proposed this model, which has proved to be probably the correct conformation for the A-beta, and Chang Jiang Tsai, who is Su Tsai, David Zanui, and Norit Haspel have also worked on this project and in experiment. I'm gratefully acknowledging Ratnesh Lal and Bruce Kagan and their colleagues. And with that, I shall close and thank you for your attention.
I think we have time for one question.
What kind of modeling did you use to make the bend in the first place? Did you just kind of do that by eye, or you said that the hydrogen bonds were optimized? So, how did you do that?
In the initial model, the hydrogen bonds are not optimized. We knew if we're testing channels in the membrane, we have to try and create channels. To begin with, a channel is an annular structure. So we simply took the experimental coordinates, extended it, and tried to bend it. And then we tried to simulate it. Too small, I should have said the 12 mer, for example, collapsed very quickly. Mm-hmm. The others, 36 mer, looked too big. I mean, you know, it didn't look supported by the bilayer. 24 mer seemed okay, but as I say, we still are not sure that a 24 mer is not too large for selectivity. So that's why we are now testing also 16, and we think it is a better size. But as far as the model, so once you close, you make an annular structure, this is what happens. I mean, the inner pore, the diameter, is such that you can form the hydrogen bonds. The outer does not. And the truth of the matter is that initially when we formed these, we didn't even pay that much attention to whether the outer strand forms or not formed, because we wanted to try and create a channel. Only when we observed the subunit structure, we thought, well, wait a minute, what is it? Why are we getting this? And then we looked, and of course, it was obvious what has happened, and it seemed a reasonable thing to happen.
Great. And just a follow-up with the 16. Okay. All right. No problem.
So we need to take this, right? Thank you.
Our next speaker is Young Chang Kim from the Theoretical Biophysics Section, Lab of Chemical Physics at NIDDK. And the title of his talk is Replica Exchange Simulations of Protein-Protein Binding and Multi-Protein Complex Formation.
Good morning, everyone. And first, I'd like to thank Suzanne and the organizers for arranging this symposium and inviting me to present our work. And today I will talk about our recent development of a coarse-grain model for protein-protein binding and its application to simulate a large multi-protein complexes using NIH BioIF cluster. So first, many biological functions are carried out by large multi-protein assemblies, and some of the examples are listed here: DNA transcriptional regulation, signal transduction, nuclear pore complex, membrane protein trafficking that is regulated by this ESCON machinery, and viral entry and release. And as you see in this cartoon illustration of this ESCON machinery, many of these biological functions involve many proteins and DNA, RNAs, and also membrane. So to better understand these biological processes, it is essential to know how these proteins are assembled and organized, in particularly near or on the membrane. But difficulties in studying structure and dynamics of these multi-protein assemblies arise from the fact that many of these assemblies are formed only transiently, held together by relatively weak pairwise interactions with the binding affinities in micromolar to millimolar range. And also these assemblies contain unstructured regions or flexible polymeric linkers that connect various well-structured domains. And these features challenge traditional approaches of structure determination, such as X-ray crystallography or NMR spectroscopy and electron microscopy. However, these challenges provide new opportunities for modeling, simulation, and theory. And here our goal is to develop a computationally efficient coarse-grain model to study structural and dynamical properties of these multi-protein assemblies that can complement experiments and provide predictions, insights, and new directions. So the outline of my talk is going to be, first, I will provide our coarse-grain model that we have developed, and then I will provide a simulation method, and then I will provide some of the validations using the structures and binding affinities of various binary protein complexes. And then we applied our coarse-grain model to several protein complexes, and I'll present its application to study structure and dynamics of the multi-protein assemblies. In particular, we studied BPS27-HSE1 complex, which is the ESCOT protein sorting machinery, part of this machinery that is responsible for membrane trafficking. And this work was done in collaboration with Jim Hurley at NIDDK. And then I will talk about how we can determine the structures of the transient encounter complexes that we observe in these multi-protein assemblies by combining our simulation data and NMR paramagnetic relaxation enhancement data of several protein complexes. And this work was done in collaboration with Marius Groh at NIDDK. So our model is based on residue level coarse graining, where we only consider C alpha coordinates. And to simplify the model, we assume the well structured domains as rigid bodies, so that these well structured domains can only move translationally or rotationally. And this decreases the number of degrees of freedom tremendously. And then we developed a transferable energy function that contains two parts. First, it has long-range Debye-Hooker-type electrostatic interactions between charged residues, and we have short-range residue-dependent interactions. And for these short-range interactions, we use Miyazawa-Zunigan statistical contact potentials obtained from a number of crystal structures. And in this transferable energy function, we have two free parameters. One is for the relative strengths of these short-range interactions compared to the electrostatic interactions, and the other one for the effects of solvent. So in our simulation, we don't explicitly use the solvents. And for these two parameters, we fitted these against two experimental data. One is the lysozyme osmotic protein second viral coefficient and ubiquitin in CUE protein binding affinity. Then many protein assemblies contain also flexible linkers. So for these flexible linkers, we consider a simple polymer model that has harmonic stretching potential and bending potential and torsion angle potential. And these potentials were tested for some of the protein folding problems. And for the membrane interactions, we consider membrane as a simple plane. And then we introduce short-range interactions between this planar membrane and 20 amino acid residues. And also we have electrostatic interactions between the negatively charged membrane and the charged residues. And we use a replica exchange Monte Carlo method to simulate these multi-protein assemblies. And we use 20 replicas at different temperatures. And this method enhances the equilibrium sampling of our system. And we implemented this replica exchange Monte Carlo in the parallel architecture of NIH BIOF cluster. First, we tested our model against various binary protein complexes. Here are the complexes between ubiquitin and various ubiquitin binding domains. And here are the plots of DRMS that is defined here. And this DRMS measures the distance of simulated structure to the native structure. And as you see, the structures that are closer to the native structure has the lower internal energy. And majority of the simulated structures, in most cases, are very close to native structures with DRMS less than 5 angstrom. Then we calculate the binding free energies for these protein complexes, and here are the data. Here is the vertical axis is the experimental binding free energy, and this horizontal axis is the simulated binding free energy. And in most cases, our simulated binding free energies are in good agreement with the experiments with an error about 1 kcal per mole. And in all cases, they agree within 2 kcal per mole error. So then after we tested our model against these various binary protein complexes, we applied this model to study the multi-protein assembly. In this case, we looked at escort machinery that is that targets ubiquitinated transmembrane proteins for protein degradation. And also, this machinery is required for HIV budding at the plasma membrane. And as you see, this machinery has many, many proteins involved. And as a first example, we studied only a small part of this protein complex, which is VPS27-HSE1 in yeast or HRS stem complex in human. And if you look at only this small part of this protein complex, actually this is highly complicated system where this complex has many well-structured domains, and these domains are connected by these flexible linkers, and this complex is responsible for targeting ubiquitinated proteins by binding to the membrane tethered ubiquitin, as shown in red here. So we applied our coarse-grained model to study how this protein complex is arranged on the membrane and how this interacts with this ubiquitinate the membrane tethered ubiquitins. And first, our simulation results show that this protein complex is highly dynamic. where the ubiquitin interacts with the various domains. And here is an example of how ubiquitin interacts with the UIM. And as you see, the ubiquitin switches very frequently between bound and unbound states with the UIM on domain. And then similar behavior is also observed in the interactions between ubiquitin and other domains. And then we calculated the radius of gyration of this protein complex, and we obtained that we observed that the radius of gyration is widely distributed, centered around 50 angstrom. And for comparison, if we consider a globular tightly packed protein with the same mass as this protein complex, then one obtains the about 30 angstrom for the radius of gyration. So what does this mean is that this protein complex is a wide open structure. And this is confirmed by a further study of human homolog HRS stem, experimentally and also simulation. So here is the structure of this protein complex. And we considered two cases where one case we cut off this C-terminal random coiled regions, and the other case is with the random coil region. And here these dashed curves are the simulation results without any constraints. And as you see, then we calculated the hydrodynamic radius that is closely related to the radius of gyration. And as you see here, these simulations without any constraints show the radius of hydrodynamic radius slightly lower than the experiments as shown in these arrows. So in order to see the structural arrangement of this protein complex, inconsistent with the experiments, we simulated the so-called restraint simulations that give the hydrodynamic radius close to the experimental value. And from these simulations, we observed that this structure is widely open, as shown here, not like tightly packed. And then we looked at the interactions between ubiquitin and various domains more closely. And first, we calculated the probability of binding of ubiquitin to UIM1 alone. And then we compared the binding probability to the binding probability of VPS27 as a whole to ubiquitin. And as you see, the binding of this VPS27 as a whole to ubiquitin is enhanced by the interaction between ubiquitin and other domains in comparison to just UIM1 alone. So from these simulations, we found that the VPS27-HSE1 complex is highly dynamic and open structure, and we believe that this plays an important role in targeting a variety of ubiquitinated cargos. And we also observed that the cooperativity binding of ubiquitin with various other domains enhances the binding of this protein complex to the membrane-tethered ubiquitin, and we think that this is essential for its function at low biological concentration. And the question is, can we observe such non-specific interactions that we saw in this simulation between ubiquitin and other various domains? And proving such non-specific interactions experimentally is very difficult because of their transient and relatively weak interactions. And however, it was shown by Gloe's group at NIDDK that it is possible to observe such low population transient encounter complexes by measuring so-called NMR paramagnetic relaxation enhancement, or PRE for short, between the paramagnetic label with an unpaired electron and a proton spin that is going to be probed. So So using this solution NMR probe, they measured the PRE spectrum of a complex between HPR and 2A mannose that is responsible for transporting sugar inside the bacteria. And in this experiment, they attached this paramagnetic manganese ion to the HPR, the opposite side of the binding interface of this protein. And then they measured this PRE signal between this manganese and the backbone amide protons of these 2A mannose. And here is the experimental PRE signal. And as you see, it has several distinct features. And then if we assume that this solution consists of only this specific the complexes as shown in this ribbon diagram, then we can calculate explicitly the PRE signal that is coming from this specific complex alone. And here is the PRE signal that is coming from this specific complex, and it is shown here as a green curve. And as you see, this specific PRE signal misses the experimental PRE signals, especially in these two regions indicated by blue arrows. And the question and this suggests that these PRE signals that are missed by this specific complex should come from non-specific complexes that are present in this solution. So the question is, can we simulate such non-specific transient encounter complexes? So we applied our coarse-grained model to simulate this HPR 2A mannose protein complex. And first, we looked at the binding free energy of this protein complex and compared it with the experiment, and we found that our simulated binding free energy is in good agreement with the error about 2.5 kcal per mole. And then we looked at what kind of structures that we get from these simulations. And here is the DRMS as a function of the energy for all the simulated structures from our coarse-grained model. And as I mentioned before, this DRMS measures the distance from the specific complex. And as you see, in our simulation, the majority, particularly more than 80% of structures are very close to stereospecific complex with DRMS less than 2 angstrom. And then the rest, about slightly less than 20% of structures are so-called encounter complexes. And using these simulating structures, then we calculated the PRE signal, and this is what we get. So in overall, actually, our simulated structures capture the experimental PRE signal pretty well. So we can reproduce these two non-specific PRE signals that were missed by this specific complex. However, we missed the dominant PRE signals here. So the question is, can we obtain this magnitude? And the possible reason for this discrepancy between simulation and the experiment is that because our model is coarse-grained, we don't expect that our model to produce accurate populations of these encounter complexes. And for example, if we have about 2 kT of binding free energy difference in these encounter complexes, then this translates into tenfold population difference. So our strategy is, in order to obtain more concrete picture of these transient encounter complexes that are consistent with experimental data, first we clustered these simulated structures into several groups based on their structures, and then reweighted their populations and fit the PRE data against PRE signal against this experimental PRE data. And this is what you get from this reweighting. As you see, now our reweighted PRE signal is very close to the experimental PRE data. And from this reweighting procedure, we learned two things. First, we found that the population of this non-specific complex is less than 10%. So more than 90% of the complexes present in the solution are specific complexes. And surprisingly, we also found that only one single non-specific cluster is enough to produce all these non-specific PRE signals. And the structure of this non-specific cluster is shown here in blue. And this encounter complex shares the binding interface of 2A manners with this specific complex, but it is rotated about 110 degrees from the stereospecific complex. And the question is, are these non-specific encounter complexes relevant to biology? And before that, we actually, from our simulations, we found that our simulation suggests that this protein-protein binding phenomena follows this funnel-like energy landscape where we have this lowest energy native or stereospecific state, and then several non-specific encounter complexes with local free energy minima, and then unbound states. So the proteins first form this non-specific encounter complex on the way to form this stereospecific complex. And these non-specific protein complexes have several biological roles. One is that these encounter complexes can accelerate this protein binding on rate. And also we learned from this simulation of the VPS27-HSE1 complex that these non-specific interactions strengthen the weak specific interactions. And it was also observed that these non-specific encounter complexes may be some alternative binding modes of these protein-protein interactions. And this is a question mark where we may think that these encounter complexes are evolutionary remnants of the early specific interactions. So in conclusion, I presented that this simple computationally efficient coarse-grained model of protein assemblies can provide valuable and complementary information regarding the structures and dynamics of the protein assemblies and transient encounter complexes. And I would like to thank my collaborators, Jim Hurley and Marius Kloe, and his former postdoc, Jun Tang, who is now at University of Missouri, and also NIH BioCluster and Helix Systems Tech to provide these wonderful computational resources. And thank you for your attention.
Any questions?
Do you use molecular dynamics or Monte Carlo simulations?
Yes. We use the Monte Carlo simulations because we wanted to look at the equilibrium structures and so basically we wanted to look at the equilibrium ensemble of the structures from for these protein complexes.
And what was the definition for the energy function? Is it completely theoretical or do you had any experimental...
For this energy function?
Yep.
Well, so this energy function is empirical. So it is based on this called statistical contact potentials that are obtained, you know, from many, from many people. So we use this one specific statistical contact potential obtained by Miyazawa, John Egan. And so just we used these potentials and we introduced just the two free parameters in order to actually scale these short-range interactions relative to the electrostatic interactions. And we also wanted to give some sort of the effects of solvents in our model, because in our simulation, we don't have explicit water molecules present. So.
One more question. So when you run the simulation, you have two parts, right? I think I understand that part. Like when you have one section, it can be embedded in the lipid layer, and one can be on the cell, right? So you have two environments coming into the protein, right? Or is it only water molecule?
I'm sorry, what?
So when you run the simulation, you can either run it on a vacuum, or you can use liquid or lipids, right?
Yeah.
So, but this one has one part.
This is just a complete in vacuum, but we just use some sort of implicit solvent model in our energy function. Yes. And also for this membrane, it's just a simple plane. There is no like lipid molecules. There are no lipid molecules, you know, floating around. So it's very simple coarse-grained model. Yes.
Thank you.
Before we move on to the next talk, are Kai Yu and Raphael Gibbs in the audience? If your slides haven't been set up, can you go to the back and talk to Steve Bailey, who will get the slides set up for your presentation next? Okay, we're all set then. Can you get my slides on? Can we have the next set of slides, please? See if you can get mine now. We'll be there in a second. So, as we've seen in some of the earlier talks, the movements of atoms within molecules affect their physical, chemical, and biological properties. And the process of simulating these movements on a computer is called molecular dynamics. To give you an idea of the computational demands of molecular dynamics jobs, I have this simulation here of a protein called apolipoprotein A1. And it's often used as benchmarks for molecular dynamics programs. So the protein, the lipid, and the water molecules add up to about 92,000 atoms. To simulate 1 nanosecond of biological time on a single CPU would take about 26 days. But we know that biological phenomena often happen on the microsecond and millisecond time scale. Simulating a millisecond of biological time with this molecule would take many thousands of years. Obviously, this is something that benefits from parallelization. And one common way in which these jobs are parallelized is by dividing up the structure into small pieces and having each piece be worked on by a different processor. The catch is that the state of the atoms in any piece depend on the state of the surrounding atoms, which may be worked on by different processors. And what this means is that the processors constantly have to trade information between each other about the state of their atoms. And this makes molecular dynamics both computationally intensive and communications intensive. So we've always had molecular dynamics jobs on the cluster, and from the beginning we've dedicated a portion of the cluster specifically to this kind of jobs. When the cluster was founded in 1999, there were 32 processors on MirrorNet, which is a high-performance, low-latency network. And each year since then, we added more processors on MirrorNet. And as you see, the processor speeds got faster as well. And in 2006, we got our first nodes on the InfiniBand network, which is also high performance and low latency. Molecular dynamics jobs are a significant proportion of the consumers of CPU cycles on the cluster. And so in 2008, we targeted our entire hardware purchase towards this kind of job, and we bought almost 1,800 processors on InfiniBand. And here's a picture of the InfiniBand switch and some of the InfiniBand nodes. So what does this buy us? Here's a benchmark, set of benchmarks run with the apolipoprotein A1 that I showed earlier. The green line is a hypothetical 100% efficiency line, which means that if you run on 100 processors, it'll run 100 times as fast as on a single processor. In real life, of course, you never get that 100% efficiency. The blue line is the same job run on our regular gigabit Ethernet nodes, and you see that at about 60 processors, we get maybe 50% efficiency, and after that, the efficiency actually gets worse, meaning if you add more processors to the job, it actually takes longer to finish. That's because communications becomes a bottleneck at that point. The pink line is the same job run on our new InfiniBand nodes, and here you could run at about 128 processors with 70% efficiency. And we use 70% efficiency as a reasonable cutoff for such jobs. So here's an example of how people at NIH are using the InfiniBand nodes. This is a simulation by Jeff Forbes at NIAMS. And it's 84 amino acid section of a muscle protein called titin. And the whole structure is about 126,000 atoms. On our gigabit Ethernet nodes, the job scales to 48 CPUs before the efficiency goes seriously downhill. And the job would take about 57 days. On the InfiniBand nodes, the job scales to 100 CPUs and would take about 12 days. So it's the difference between 2 weeks and 2 months. This is where we would like to go with molecular dynamics. This is a virus particle in a box of water, and it has about 1 million atoms. This is an order of magnitude bigger than the apolipoprotein A1, and simulating a nanosecond takes about 200 days. And here's the benchmarks for that job. And as before, this is the hypothetical 100% efficiency. And what this shows is that you could run on about 250 processors at 70% efficiency. And in practice, what that means is that you go from 200 days to simulate a nanosecond down to 1 day. So this is within the bounds of reason for a researcher to researcher's time frame. And this is our goal, to make it, to enable projects that would otherwise not be possible at all. Thank you. Our next speaker is Kai Yu from the Division of Cancer Epidemiology and Genetics at NCI. And the title of his talk is Population Substructure and Control Selection in Genome-Wide Association Studies.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about a project we conduct in NCI and on genome-wide association study, which in this project we use extensively the BioWolf cluster. So I would like first to acknowledge the contributions of my collaborators, and in case I forgot in the end of the talk, especially, I would like to thank the staff to have created this BioWolf clusters, which makes our project possible, and it's a tremendous help for our research. So I will talk about some background about this research and motivation for this work, and then I will present some results. So genome-wide association study has become a popular tool for identify genes for complex disease. So in NCI, we study cancers, and in a typical GWAS study of, say, breast cancer, and we usually have a few thousand cases and a few thousand controls. On each subject, we measure their genotypes on 500,000 to 1 million SNPs
throughout the genome. So the typical analysis involved is you just compare the genotype frequencies at each genetic markers, in this case it's SNPs, on each of the half a million or a million SNPs. So you do a half a million tests. One issue, so the popular design for this study is case control design. One issue about this population-based design is a population stratification, which means that a SNP can turn out to be looks as if they are associated with the outcome if you compare their genotype frequencies between case and controls and find a difference, but not due to their due to the SNP is related to the outcome, but it's because the case controls has a different ancestral background. Because the way you select them, and there are some bias or some unrecognized substructure in the sample. So this is a very typical example for we call it a confounding by ethnicity. Okay, so here's a typical example in literature. So this is a study on height. So they measured a SNP on LCT gene. If you look at the, all their samples, if you don't just do a straightforward analysis, compare the genotype frequencies. So this is the frequencies on each type of genotypes, on a case of a group of tall people versus a group of short people, and you have got a very significant result. But if you recognize that people, so this is in all European Americans. So if you recognize that people with a northern and western European ancestry tend to be taller than the people from with a southeastern European ancestry, so if you stratify the sample by into three categories, so those are the four grandparents are all from all U.S. born, and this is our four grandparents are all from southeastern European ancestry, and this is northwestern European ancestry. And if you divide your data into three parts and you test, compare the genotype frequencies between case and controls in each subgroups, the signal basically will go away. So this is a very typical example of population stratification because in your sample, in your case and control sample, the proportion of subjects from each of their ancestral background are different. So in this case, for the group of tall people, most of them are from with a northwestern European ancestral background. And it turned out to be, that SNPs turned out to be a SNP that have a different allele frequencies on those two ancestral backgrounds. So this is a very typical example for population stratification. So there are two ways population stratification can occur. One is called due to risk, due to the disease risk heterogeneity across the subpopulations. So in this case, in that previous example, and so people with a different ancestral background tend to be taller than another background. And so if you do a case control studies, if you didn't recognize that substructure and the disease risk heterogeneity, it's likely you will end up with two samples with a different, slightly different ancestral background. And another ways to for population stratification occur is due to sampling bias. That is basically, there's no heterogeneity in terms of the risk, but the way you collect the case and control samples are slightly different. So it may end up with a different ancestral background in the two samples. Okay, so the motivation for this research is that, so there's an outstanding debate on the impact of population stratification on well-designed genetic studies. Some even question the population-based case control design and insist that we should do always do family-based study for genetic studies. And to another extreme, now there's more and more genome-wide study becomes available, and there's a tendency to use we call external controls, that is controls from another studies, a group of normal people from another studies. So for your future studies, you just need to collect cases for your study. For controls, you just borrow studies from borrow controls from another study. So this is a tremendous cost-saving strategies. But so what is the impact of population stratification in this kind of strategy if you use these external controls in your study? So is the population stratification effect is so significant that it will ruin your study? So we want to see using empirical data to evaluate these two issues. So the focus of the talk is we are going to use data generated from the CGM study and I will talk about more about this. We are going to evaluate the population stratification effect in GWAS conducting the European American populations. Especially we want to see what is the impact of, what is the extent of population stratification in the two sampling strategies. One is nest case control design, which is studied and very epidemiology and rigorous design and to study for case control design. And another is use external controls, that is you just borrow controls from another study. So what is the impact of population stratification under those two different sampling strategies? And also we want to study how do we correct for population stratification if it does exist in the studies. Okay, so here's a few words about the CGM study, and this is called Cancer Genetic Marker of Susceptibility and for prostate and breast cancers. So this is a NCI-sponsored GWAS studies and to study two common cancers. One is prostate cancers in men, and another is breast cancer in women. And they are very common and has a high impact in public health. So we are going to use the data generated from the initial studies, which is the phase one study. So here is the material for our analysis. So for prostate cancer GWAS, we are going to use a sample was collected from this POCO clinical trial. It's a cancer prevention trial. So we collect about 1,100 prostate cancer cases and a roughly same number of controls from this cohort. And this is for prostate cancer. And for breast cancer study, we collect roughly same number of breast cancer cases and controls from the nurses' health study. This is a prospective cohort study on nurses. Okay, so those are all assumed with European and ancestral background people. For the SNP, we use the Illumina platform. So basically, there are about 500,000 SNPs on the platform, and we focus on the autosome SNPs. This is the number of SNPs we're going to focus on. So the experiment that we are going to do is that. So this is the two original study. This is from the prostate cancer study. We have prostate cancer cases versus controls from the same cohort. Okay, this is the original breast cancer study from NHS, case and controls. And the two experiments we did is we use, when we suppose you are doing a study on prostate cancers, you use prostate cancer cases from POCO, but you use controls from another study. Okay, so in this case, we are using men versus women. So this is just for experiment. And another experiment we did is just use breast cancer cases versus prostate cancer for controls from another study. So we have four experiments. So for study population stratification, and especially in GWAS setting, we know the majority of the markers and we measure are non-markers. So those markers actually are very useful for us to evaluate and correct for population stratifications. We can monitor the extent of the population stratifications because we assume most of the markers are non-markers. So their p-values should follow a uniform distributions. And also we can use those non-markers to correct for population stratifications if they do exist. So in this case, talk, I'm going to focus on using the principal component analysis for the evaluation and the correction for population stratification. So here is the set of SNPs we're going to use. So first we identify about 12,000 SNPs for the evaluation of population structure. They are relatively independent. And then we want to evaluate, we identify another a quarter million SNPs, which are relatively less related to this set of SNPs. We want to see what is the impact if we decided to adjust for population stratification. What is the effect of adjustment by testing those quarter million SNPs? So this is just a general idea of a principal component analysis. Basically, for each subject, we have their measurement on 12,000 SNPs, which we think those are give us information on their ancestral background. So we want to reduce that dimension into a lower dimension, hopefully in two or three dimensions, so we can visualize their population structures. So here is the very basic example of a PCA. So in this case, you have points on the three dimensions, and you want to represent them into two-dimensional space. And the idea is that you want to find a space in two-dimensional space in the original three-dimensional space that and they represent their relatively distance between the original point. And so in this case, and if you represent them in the two-dimensional space, those points will be into a two principal component. So here a proof of principle. So in this case, we use the yellow points are represent for subjects from the nurses' health study, which are European and Americans. And we also throw in the HapMap data, which and this is about this is Chinese. And the red point represents people from Africa. And this is the Utah itself. This is from this represents a European ancestral population. So you will see that if you plot them, so each subject has a measurement on each of the 12,000 SNPs. And if you reduce the dimension into two dimensions, then represent each subject in this two-dimensional space, you will see that you know the these two are well overlapped, so which is makes sense because they are all European ancestral background. And you will see that Asia and people from Asia and Africans are well separated. So this is a proof of principle why principal component works can help you to study population stratification, population structure. And so here is a representation of our sample in the first two principal component space. So this is the prostate cancer studies, and this is the subjects looks like in these two dimensions. And very interestingly in that we see very similar patterns in the two studies, which are totally different. One is on two different cohorts, and one is on men and the other is on women. And yet you will see that, you know, very similar patterns. The different colors in each plot represent their case control status. Okay, so, and also you will see that the case and controls are seem to be mixed well. So it means that there's no an obvious difference in terms of the distributions along each of the directions. But if you test them, so as I mentioned, we have four experiments. These two are the two original studies. You use the same case and controls, case and controls from the same cohort. And these two are the experiments. So we use controls, we borrow controls from another studies. And then we test the case control distributions on each of the principal component directions. So we only focus on the first five directions. And this is their repeat values. So basically you will see that on the original two design, which we collect case and controls from the same population cohort, and there's no obvious evidence for population stratification because case and controls are well matched on each of those major directions. But for the two experiments we did, there are significant difference between case and controls in terms of their positions on the principal component direction. So here is some evidence that, you know, if you use controls from another studies, there's danger that you will have a impact by population stratifications because case controls might not well matched on each of those directions. So here's some other observations. So we also, as I mentioned, we observed very similar population structures in those two cohorts. So in this case, we come back to this plot. So even though there are two studies and there are very similar patterns. And also we can measure the impact of population stratification by the inflation factor, which is basically you just compare your test statistics. In this case, we measure them on a quarter million SNPs, and on each test of statistics, if all of them are null, we know their median expected values under the null. And then we calculate the observed median values. and use the ratio as the inflation measurement. So the larger means that you have high inflation and in terms of your in terms of your test statistics. So example, so if you use a 1 degree freedom classical statistics, so basically you measure the median of your statistics on those quarter million SNPs and compare to this value. Okay. So here is another way to measure the population stratification effect is through this QQ plot. So basically you plot the p-values, the log transfer p-values, the ranked p-values versus the expected ones. And ideally, they should follow these diagonal lines. But if your observed p-values tend to be less than expected, you will see this shift from the diagonal line. So the more shift, the means there are a strong effect due to population stratifications. Under the assumption that the vast majority of your SNPs are disease unrelated, which is probably true for cancer. So in this case, if you look at if you just plot those test statistics values and the p-values, and on the two original studies, you'll see that they are well aligned and on the diagonal line, but there are some points and off the diagonal line. Probably some of them are, hopefully there are signals there. Okay, but for the two experiments, you will see a large extent of degree difference between the two lines. You know, that means there is a large degree of population stratification effect, and this is also confirmed by this inflation measurement. So those two are this one is larger than this one. Okay, and if you look at the curve, also there are much the gap between these two lines is much larger than this one. So the same thing on these two experiments. Okay, so how do we correct them if we do observe their population stratification effect? And so the standard ways to do this is that, and so assume and use the logistic regression model for your test. So this is your genotypes on a particular testing SNPs. Okay, so you want to test the effect of the genotypes. And we can adjust for the principal component we obtained from the PCA analysis. So in this case, we choose the first two principal components for the adjustment to then use this model, and we measure the effect of the SNPs by measuring this parameter, whether this is equal to zero or not. Okay. So strategy is then, the common strategy is to use the first few principal components in this model. So in this case, we choose the first two. Okay, and people even suggest you use top 10 principal component in the adjustment. And as we mentioned that, in order to have a population stratification effect, if case and controls are well matched on certain directions, you don't have to match them. Appropriate strategy could be you just pick principal components that are correlated with the outcome. So in that example, for example, for this study, and you will see that case controls are well matched on each of the directions. So it's not necessary to adjust for those principal components. So the consequences of adjust an unnecessary principal component is that there's a danger of losing power. Okay. So we provide a algorithm to select a principal component for population stratification corrections. So this is a very computationally intensive algorithm because we have this BioWolf clusters, we are afford to do this. So basically, we want to see that for each principal component we added in, we want to evaluate whether by adding this principal component into the model, it will significantly reduce the effect of population stratifications, which is measured by an inflation factor lambda. So in this case, let's just go over this algorithm briefly. Say we rank those principal components in terms of their Wilcox rank statistic, which is compare this statistic is compared case control distributions on each of the directions. So the first one is the one which casing controls are list matched. And then we put the first one in, okay? And then we can compute the observed inflation factors on those quarter million SNPs. So we put each SNPs in and we do a test based on this model, and we can measure their inflation factors on the quarter million SNPs. Then we randomly permute this principal component, say 200 times. Each time we rerun the model, but using this principal component, which is permuted version, and run each of the SNPs, and get another inflation factors for each permuted version. So the idea is that in order to have this principal component to add in the model, we only want to use them if by including it, we will significantly reduce the effect of operating stratification. So using these permutation procedures, we can evaluate the effect of adjustment of this principal component. So so this can be computationally very intensive because for each permutation, you are going to run a quarter million test. Okay. So you can continue this algorithm. So assuming we have already added the first two principal components that you want to test, whether you want to add this one, we are going to the same algorithm to permute this principal components and do the analysis again and to measure their to evaluate the, whether the observed inflation factor is significantly reduced. Okay, so in the end, for those four experiments, we end up with choosing for the first, for the POCO prostate cancer study, we only need to choose the first principal component for the adjustment. For the original breast cancer study, we only need to adjust for the second principal component. But for the two experiments we did, which we observed more evidence of population stratification, we are going to adjust three principal components. So for this one is the first two and the fourth one. And for this one is the first three. So what is the result of the adjustment? So here is the table. And so for each studies, you can adjust the first one or the, so you either don't adjust or adjust first principal component to 10. So this one is you adjust the first 10 principal components. And this is the one we adjust for the principal component identified by the algorithm. Okay, you will see that even though if you look at the focus on the second columns, and so by adjusting three instead of five, instead of 10, you basically achieve the same amount of reduction in terms of the effect of population stratifications. We can also look at the QQ plot, and so. So compare the QQ plot with and without a PC adjustment. So this is one is the original study without adjustment, and this is the after adjustment. So in this case, if your study casing controls are taken from the same population cohort, you don't see much of the effect of population stratification. So it's not surprised to see that the adjustment and unadjustment, there's no big difference. But if you look at this one, and so this is unadjusted QQ plot, and this is the adjusted QQ plot. So you will see that and after adjustment of the two principal, three principal components in this case, you will achieve some. So the result is kind of more obvious. You will see that by adjusting three principal components, you will reduce the inflation factor from 1.09 to 1.03. Okay. And so this is another experiment for the breast cancer cases, so the same patterns. So what we, based on our experiment, what we observe that is that basically we think a population heterogeneity exists in European American populations, but population stratification does not appear to be a problem in well-designed studies. So this is still very vague. So well-designed means you collect casing controls from the same cohort and follow the design and guidelines carefully. And also, the problem of population stratification is more extensive when you borrow controls from another studies. But with the help of the adjustment of principal component, it might be able to reduce those effects. So basically, we use empirical data, and this data are all from populations with European American background. So for other populations, we need to do further studies, especially for African Americans. We don't know the answer yet. And also, there are more issues to be considered and when we want to use the strategy of external controls. You know, there are a lot more issues other than population structures, population stratifications, such that, you know, what are the covariate measurement between the two samples, and how did you harmonize the measurement on the other covariate measurement? Because usually, if you borrow controls from another studies, those measurement has been done. So what if there are measurement, the two measurements on your cases and controls, and the measurement on the external controls are not well matched? So how do you use those informations? So those are practical issues that we have to address. And if you want to use the external control for your studies. So I will stop here and take some questions. So for breast cancer, so far we probably identify about, currently we know there are maybe 12 SNPs, independent SNPs are truly related to breast cancer. So I don't know whether that will still true and if more studies and results come in, but we don't expect much of the SNPs are truly related to breast cancer risk, especially for those, particularly for those SNPs with minor allele frequencies and bigger than 5%. But there may be some rare mutations which will elevate the risk for breast cancer, but for this type of GWAS study, we focus on relatively common SNPs.
So how many of them relate to, say, BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutations versus, say, the ERBs mutations?
So we don't know this and for these studies. But for BRCA SNPs, and those are not included in this panel because they are very rare mutations. So the strategy for this GWAS for the GWAS study is to at least at present phase is to focus on those common SNPs, which probably has a more impact on the public health.
Two questions actually. First and foremost, when you do principal component analysis, you're doing it in order to also possible that you're correcting for other differences between cases and controls, for example, age, gender, et cetera, et cetera. And the second question is that algorithm of yours publicly available? Can you use it?
Yes.
Can you repeat the question, please?
So the first question is, so for principal component analysis, so whether, his question is whether it is can be used to correct for other effect, like the, we do see that sometimes, there is a genotyping error. There's a chance that the principal component can pick it up. Say, for example, I don't have the result here. So if you can check the loading of each SNPs on each of the principal component directions. And if there's a big spike on a particular SNPs or a group of SNPs in the region, and there may be some suspicions on whether there are some errors in this region, or there are some artifact. Because ideally, you want to use SNPs which relatively are less correlated, so you don't want local LD patterns to highly influence your result. But I don't think it will be useful to correct for the other effect, like the age effect. I don't see that. I can't see that. So in terms of the algorithm, we implement that in R. So it's still not user friendly, but because you have to use these clusters. We don't expect people where other people were using, unless they are in NIH. So and they don't have these facilities to use this and algorithm. It's just require too much of computation. But it can be very easily implemented if you have the software and any statistical package, and you can do that. And it is parallel because you test each SNP and it's very easy to separate your data into maybe 50 copies and run them parallel in more clusters. So we don't see there's difficulty to implement them and in your own studies.